You're listening to Stand Out with Ian O'Connell, Wednesday evenings from 8 p.m. here on Radio Kerry. See it to be it on Radio Kerry with Ian O'Connell.
Now, you're very welcome to the show tonight. I hope I find you well on this Wednesday evening. I'm delighted to say that my guest this week on Stand Out with myself, Ian O'Connell, is Teresa Ferris. Teresa is a former Sinn Féin politician who has served as a Kerry County Councillor for Tralee from 2003 to 2019. Ferris is a part-time tutor in law at the Tralee Community College. In 2001, Ferris spent 7 months working in Mexico with a local workers' rights group. In the 2014 Kerry County Council election, Ferris was elected on the first count and topped the poll in the Tralee local electoral area. Ferris started her political activism with Sinn Féin's youth wing, Ógra Sinn Féin, in her native Tralee and at the University of Limerick, co-opted in 2003 to the Kerry County Council seat held by her father, Martin Ferris. She immediately became the Sinn Féin chairperson of the council. Sit back and enjoy the show. Thanks a million for joining me today. How's everything with you?
Good, Ian. Thanks very much, and thank you for having me on.
We're saying there, it's flat out outside in Killarney. The sun is out and everybody's out.
It's fabulous to see, yeah. It is. Not nice being stuck in traffic in it, but it's nice to see the town so busy.
Even yesterday, the evening so bright, like... Even for your own head, it kind of, do you know, the brightness?
Yeah.
Darker.
Lifts the mood, doesn't it?
It does, it does.
Yeah.
Dark at 4 o'clock, there's nothing worse.
Yeah.
Do you want to, what was, I suppose, your childhood, like, what were you, I suppose, interested in? Were you sports or what?
Absolutely not, Ian. I was allergic to anything that involved, physical exertion. So I was probably unique as a child in that I was always really interested in the bigger world issues.
Yeah.
I had an interest in politics from a young age, especially social justice and issues like that. And at school, history would have been my favourite subject. I absolutely loved it. And I was disgusted when I was in third class. I got 99% in an exam, and when I asked the teacher where did I lose the 1%, she told me that my spelling was so appalling that she couldn't give me the 100%. Yeah.
And apparently you're supposed to, I think you get like so many marks for you putting your name down on exam paper as well, I think.
Yeah, well, I suppose this was third class, and at the time I did challenge the teacher as to the relevance of spelling and grammar to knowledge of historical events, and I think she was tempted to take another couple of percentage off me for asking that. So, I just took the 99 and won't say I was happy, but I just accepted it.
Took it and accepted it. Did you, was history always, I suppose, the kind of subject that you, like, would work for me now, was the one I absolutely... loved. Was that the kind of one that you'd look forward to doing every day?
Loved it, absolutely. Right through secondary as well. And I was blessed in that we had Eamon Fitzmaurice Senior.
Yeah.
And whilst I was fortunate to have so many exceptional teachers throughout my educational history, he's up there with one of the best teachers I've ever encountered. And you just listened. It wasn't a case of reading through a textbook, which probably wouldn't have hindered my learning too much, but I'm much more of an oral learner.
Yeah.
So he just told stories in class, and he was so passionate about the subject as well. And I had Austin O'Shaughnessy before that for the junior cycle, and he laid a really excellent foundation. So that even though I knew I always wanted to study law, and I had hoped for quite some time to pursue a career practicing law, but when it came to selecting the university where I would go on to study that subject, I wanted to also study history. So that's how I ended up in the University of Limerick. It was the only university on the island of Ireland at that time that gave an option of history with law.
With another one.
I had applied for Queen's as well through UCAS.
Is that Belfast?
In Belfast. But that would have been my second choice because it gave you a politics option, not a history. So I was delighted when I did get University of Limerick and Law and European. Yeah.
And where did you grow up originally when you were?
I grew up in Arfort.
Arfort.
In the village of Arfort.
And I suppose some of your friends were mad hurling, were they?
hurling, football, soccer, you name it, every kind of a band going, and definitely not interested in politics or history. So it was a bit of an outlier in that. But it was the cause of much slagging at the time. I tried to participate in the games and stuff that they were interested in, but just never did it for me. No.
And like that's what you said there, it's important, because I think sometimes, I suppose, parents, they might put too much pressure on a child to get into sports. Like I've seen it, some of my friends that they're not men sports, but you know, I suppose it, like you said there, some people are sports, some people are kind of different, like your interest in history. It's important for, I suppose, parents not to push them into something that they don't like. Sure, it's not.
Yeah, and in fairness, credit to my mother always encouraged my interests. So
really?
I would have joined an international division of the junior ANC when I was about maybe 9 or 10. And it was through a friend of hers that I was able to get the correspondence address.
Yeah.
And they would have both encouraged me. So I would have gotten, you know, mail letters about the update about the anti-apartheid regime in South Africa at the time. So my mother would have been supportive and encouraging of that. And in fairness, with all her kids, she would have encouraged whatever our interests were.
Yeah.
Like, I have three brothers and they're GAA fanatics.
Are they?
Yeah, yeah. They have a couple of All-Ireland club medals between them as well. So, yeah.
Different sides, though.
Yeah.
And we were speaking before we came on the interview, and I suppose, was it from a young age you found out you had dyslexia? Was that from a young age or?
No, I actually was in Leaving Cert year. And
oh, really?
I wasn't formally diagnosed. What it was at the end of fifth year, we got a new English teacher and he noticed a pattern with the mistakes that I was making. And he asked me if I could bring in my history and my Irish copybooks to him. And he went through them. And in his opinion, there were indicators of dyslexia there. So I didn't think too much about it. And he sent some correspondence off to the department. Like this would have been probably after Christmas when he did that. And just before the Leaving Cert, we got word back that I would get a waiver for spelling and grammar.
Really?
Which was a huge relief, because right from primary through to the end of secondary school, the consistent feedback from teachers, even not just in language subjects, was, you know, very good, achieving high grades, but, you know, not putting enough effort into learning her spelling. And though I wouldn't have performed very poorly in spelling tests in primary school, they wouldn't have matched the results I would have been receiving
when
if spelling
did.
Wasn't taken into account.
Yeah. And I suppose when that teacher did kind of do that with you, was there other children that were in the same boat, or was it?
Not that I'm aware of, because I went to an all-Irish school and we were a very small class. There was only 20 of us in the year. So I'm not aware of that, but I wouldn't have gotten, like, there was 35, 36 of us in primary school, and there would have been a number of class colleagues who would have been taken out for
resource and extra
hours.
Yeah.
But at the time it was called remedial. I mean, what a disgusting terminology to use for it.
Is that what they used to say?
Yeah, and I have it in my head as well. I don't know if it was the other students or the teachers would have used slow learners class.
Really?
Yeah, it was disgusting and appalling. And I left primary school with class colleagues who were very bright, no less bright than I and the rest of us were, but had real literacy issues even when they left school.
Yeah.
And it limited their life choices after that. So I suppose I became aware of the huge disadvantage faced by people at a young age for things that they had no control or input into.
Yeah.
So then when it came to Leaving Cert, I'll be honest, I was just so delighted and relieved, thinking, okay, at least now in my French exam, I'm not going to be brought down because of my spelling.
Spelling,
yeah. And I don't have to spend the weeks preparing, kind of trying to memorize the spelling when it's not something that's going to come against me.
Yeah.
And the same with Irish. So when I left and I got my course and I started in college, I was just so relieved to get it. And I never looked into dyslexia in any way, which was a big mistake, because I was studying law and obviously history.
Yeah.
And there's an awful lot of learning off by heart in that as well, and rote learning, and you need accuracy around sections of legislation, case law,
so
names and all of that.
Isn't there?
Yeah, so like the dyslexia came against me in first year in college, and I was always, and for the Leaving Cert, my subject was history.
History.
And I ran out of time. and there was a full question that I didn't get to answer.
Really?
And I was gutted. It was the first year you could see your Leaving Cert results, and I was 0.5% off of an A in history.
Are you serious?
Yeah. And I had just literally a couple of bullet points for my last question. So I should have probably appealed, because I would have automatically been brought up, but yeah, they could have brought you down that year as well as bringing you up.
Oh, they can bring you down that year as
well? That was the first year that they introduced that, because you could view your papers. If you appeal, they could bring you down. So I didn't do much about it, but it was when I was in first year in college and the Christmas and summer exams. I mean, I ran out of time in every single exam. And it was only then that I discovered that if I registered with the Disability Liaison Officer, because of the nature of my disability, I could get extra time in exams and supports and resources in terms of my learning. So that summer I was assessed and I got my formal diagnosis and I registered, and thereafter I got an extra half an hour in the exam. And the difference between my results in first year and thereafter
was night and day.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's brilliant that, you know, that you had that extra time to do it, because like you said, it wasn't so much the spelling, it was the time that was kind of catching you, like.
Yeah, because the nature of my dyslexia, I struggle greatly with structure.
Yeah.
And, you know, trying to structure my answer in a coherent way in the time that's allocated to students that don't have that struggle was difficult enough. And plus, you know, not stressing out in the middle of the exam about the name of the case. Is it Murphy versus Sullivan, or is it Sullivan versus Murphy? And I mean, there's a big difference between the two. So at least I managed to get some consideration for those challenges, and it worked out.
It worked out. And did it knock your, I suppose, self-confidence in any way when you did get the original diagnosis when you were?
No, because I suppose I was unique in that I was so relieved to have it, because I could see the benefits that it could give me by having the formal diagnosis.
Yeah.
I had suffered up until that point all the disadvantages of actually being dyslexic, but by having a piece of paper recognising that, I could finally get some allowances for it, and it wasn't going to, you know, penalise me the way that it had been up until that point. But I suppose I grew up in a household where difference was to be embraced.
Yeah.
And you didn't treat difference as something less. So maybe that conditioning and that is why I responded the way I did. But I was just very relieved. But what was really interesting about my first ever meeting with Brenda Shinners Kennedy, I'll never forget her, she was the Disability Liaison Officer in UL, was, you know, she told me that I should not have done my education Oscailing. That being dyslexic, learning through a different language was going to be a huge challenge. I shouldn't have been doing Spanish as part of my degree. I shouldn't have been doing history, and I should not have been doing a law degree. So it's great to see, you know, with the tools that are there to support, how none of that matters now anymore.
Absolutely.
And I suppose I was, you know, just at the start of that age where you had technology assistance, but I was probably too late to benefit from it.
Yeah.
So it's great to see what my own students today, all the tools that are there.
And the resources they have.
Exactly. Yeah. To make any difference like that negligible in terms of its impact on how the opportunities are taken on by those students.
This interview now for people, you know, that might be getting diagnosed with dyslexic, you know, to know that they can go on, and it's not a barrier that will stop them from going on and achieving things in life.
Yeah, exactly. And I suppose I had the double whammy, and probably the barrier that's still there, notwithstanding all the tools that are people who are coming from poverty, are financial disadvantage. You know, that, in my view, is the biggest barrier that's there. And then if you do have extra challenges and you don't have access to the resources that more privileged equivalents do, that's the one piece of the jigsaw I don't think that we've gotten right yet. And full credit to Norma Foley as Minister for Education. I mean, bringing in free school books, allocating that extra for transition year. It's trying to make a difference. And I'm not a fan of the Leaving Cert system.
Yeah.
I think it is a system that for 100 years this year has just perpetuated inequality.
Yeah.
Better resourced students perform better. And I think any educational system should be looking at the individual unique skills and competencies of the students, not the resources that they have behind them. And it was interesting listening to Colm Nachter yesterday about his article about how grinds are being used to unfairly advantage more privileged students. And it took me right back to, it was actually, I'll never forget the first time I heard any teacher or anybody in education talk like that, and it's the aforementioned Máistre MacMirish, Eamon Fitzmaurice Senior. We were in fifth year and he was giving us a lecture about those of us in our cohort who were using grinds, and his terminology was to artificially inflate your points. And I sat there thinking, you're 100% right. He was of the mentality that the only students that should be getting grinds are those that are genuinely struggling with the subject. And if teachers were doing their job right, I suppose he was looking at this through the lens of 1997, when they were a bit better resourced than maybe what they are now, then students wouldn't be struggling to the point that they need to get grinds. Teachers would provide that service for them. So it's gas that we're all these years on, and we still have a system that discriminates against people based on their socioeconomic status.
People that might be struggling, like you said. I suppose, moving on, what was your first memory of, politics?
Politics.
From a young age?
My first memory of active involvement would have been the European elections when Father Paddy Ryan ran in what would have been then the Munster constituency, and being sat at our kitchen table, licking browned envelopes, putting newsletters into envelopes, licking them and sealing them. I can still taste the glue and the irony of brown envelopes when we saw what they became associated with in politics quite some time later. So that would be active involvement. Then we had the presidential election, and the year that Brian Lenihan was a candidate and that Mary Robinson became the first female president of Ireland, Brian Lenihan's tour bus came to Ardfert, and there was an IRA prisoner who was now a TD, Desi Ellis. He was on hunger strike in Portlaoise prison at the time, so my job was to sneak onto the bus when all the aides weren't looking and to leaflet the bus with Desi Ellis posters. Don't let Desi die. And I would have been writing letters to Desi at the time, and I suppose a couple of years before that I would have signed up to the junior ANC, so I would have been, you know, involved in petitions and stuff like that about the apartheid regime in South Africa.
What did you enjoy most about being in politics yourself?
I loved the advocacy. And had I pursued a career in law, that's exactly what I would have been doing anyway. I loved challenging anomalies and inequalities that are there in the system, and helping people who hadn't found it until that point find their voice and speak for themselves and challenge anything that was wrong. That was my favourite part of it.
And was it 2004?
2003, September 2003. 2003. Yeah, I was actually enrolled to sit the entrance exams for King's Inn.
Really?
I finished my degree that summer, and the plan was to go to King's Inn and become a barrister. So the party approached me and asked me would I consider giving 1 year commitment, being co-opted in September, standing in the local elections, hopefully holding the seat, and then the following September doing the King's Inn entrance exams. And I'll never forget that local election in 2004, and a couple of days afterwards saying, right, you know, you need to find someone now that's going to replace me on the council, and being told, no, you're after giving a 5 year commitment to the electorate, and they know what buttons to push, because one thing I am is I'm a person of my word.
Yeah.
And when it was presented that way, I knew, well, you know, I'm going to honour my commitment.
You're in it now.
Yeah. So it was put on the back burner, and however many years later, I still haven't done it, but I've done a lot of other things in between.
Yeah. And I suppose when you decided to kind of step away from politics, was, I suppose, because like you see now, like politics, it takes up a lot of your time.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose it's like the likes of me now, or the normal person, they don't see what goes on in the background, like the commitments and everything. It is a lot, like, isn't it?
It is. I mean, I was, just to, so the people will understand, I was working full time as an elected representative, regardless of, you know, I think it was it 17,000 euro a year was the salary I was getting.
Yeah.
But I was doing that full time, so 50 hours plus a week. And when my husband ended up out of work because of a back injury and then the recession, we had a mortgage that was over €1,000 a month.
Yeah.
So I had to take on some hours teaching law in the further ed college in order to supplement our income so that we could survive. And I was only doing, I think, about 10 hours a week at that. And I was coming out with as much as I was my 50 hours plus. But money has never been a motivating factor, but that's just to equate it. I mean, half a rate of a teacher's salary was what I was getting for doing my full-time work as an elected rep, and I was putting in nearly five times the hours.
It's mad, isn't it?
Yeah. So it's all consuming, especially for someone like me. I can't do something, you know, with a bit of an effort. I'm all in. But I suppose I came through a period as well where it was acceptable to be absolutely horrible to certain people in elected office. And I'm delighted to see that there is less tolerance for that now and it's called out. But I mean, I lived through months of having every publication in the country comment on my physical appearance.
Yeah.
And I'm someone who had body image issues anyway.
Yeah.
Refer to me as a slut and a slapper, someone who obviously shopped in Peter Stringfellas. And
I remember reading that in an article when it came out that time. Like, that's...
Yeah, it was appalling. But what was worse was the silence.
Yeah.
And the silence of the women's organisation. I don't think I will ever forgive those who were involved in the National Women's Council at the time.
Not sending up kind of...
No, it was a female politician. You had an article, I'll never forget, Mary Lou was pregnant. And there was an article about Mary Lou... what was the term that they used for the handing over of arms at the time? Decommissioning. Mary Lou decommissions an entire bakery. The woman was pregnant and they thought it was okay to comment on her physical appearance. There was disgusting commentary about Mary Harney as well, who was Taoiseach at the time. But there was nobody saying anything to call it out or challenge it. And it's the one regret I have. There were several articles that were defamatory about me at the time, and I didn't challenge them. And I think I often look back and say, well, if I had, would that maturity that has arrived now in that we'll no longer tolerate that, would that have happened sooner? And could taking the action back then have prevented other people being subjected to the vitriol that I was at the time? I'll never know the answer, but it is one of my few regrets from that time.
What year would that have been?
2006.
And like, obviously social media wouldn't have been...
Oh, it was all over social media.
Like, compared to social media now, like, you see under, say, like, TDs or politicians, say, tweets or anything they have on, like, the comments are, they're horrible. Like, do you think that social media, it can be a great thing for certain things, but then there's that negative side?
That's because we've left it to them to regulate themselves.
Yeah.
And we actually thought they were going to. It's ridiculous. There should be much, I suppose, more proactivity from a legislative point of view in terms of regulating what's happening. Even if you take it away from the vitriol and the horribleness that we see too often on social media, even things like, I'm looking at especially young men and women now, their insecurities about their own image and how there isn't a law here like what we have in France, where if you put up an image that's photoshopped and isn't real, you were legally obliged to state that on the image.
Oh, really?
And we have too many young people here looking at these artificial images, believing that it's reality and thinking that that's what they have to try and aspire to. So we're way behind the curve in terms of responding to the dangers of technology. There's huge amounts of benefits, especially with social media, getting your message out there that, you know, the more traditional media might have silenced for too many years. But we should be much more proactive in countering the harm that is being caused as well.
I've said it on a lot of interviews that I've done with social media. Like, I see my own, like, I share my own story on, say, like, since I had my accident up till now, just kind of documenting it. But, like, I'd see the odd comment there, you know, a negative or a dig they throw at you. But I always have said on a lot of interviews, when you're making an account on, say, Instagram or Twitter, you should have to show like your passport so everything can be brought back to you for stuff that you might say. Do you, what do you think about that?
I agree with you 100%. And it's really brave of you to put yourself out there like that. Because I don't know, are you like the majority of us where it's those negative comments that you actually pay far more attention to?
Yeah.
It's a gift for people who are able to not take that on board. I think for the majority of us, we do let it get inside our head and impact on how we behave after that.
Like I always kind of ignore them. But then if there's one bad one, like, or if it's a message, I don't entertain it because that's what they want.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's bad, like, I'd text back and I'd say kind of, come here, it doesn't affect me one bit. But you might say that to some person and it might push them over the edge. That mightn't be able to, you know, rub it off their back. And like you said, body image, like you said, it's a big thing these days.
Yeah.
Like, they're looking up at them social media influencers off the likes of Love Island and stuff. And it's sad to see young girls like that aren't even in their teens yet that are looking at that, thinking that that's reality.
Yeah. I blame the Kardashians.
Yeah, the Kardashians.
I think they were one of the worst things to happen.
They were, like, and it's awful to see. I suppose we've seen now with politics lately, like Varadkar now and Simon Cope, they're all after kind of stepping down. When you did kind of leave politics, did you ever have any, I suppose, regrets?
None, to be honest. And if I'm very, very honest, the only regret I have, even though it was, I mean, it was an honour for the people to trust me for as long as they did to occupy that position on their behalf. But from a personal point of view and from my family's point of view, my only regret is that I stayed as long as I did.
Yeah.
I had tried to leave politics earlier. Much earlier. I allowed myself to be convinced not to, and my family have paid the price for that.
Yeah.
And at the time, it was my family that I was making that decision for. But there's nothing I can do to change that now, and I have to live with the consequences of that.
At least, you know, that you've stepped away, and like you said, that would be the only regret that you have. Would you recommend, I suppose, people to, particularly women, would you kind of, if they were interested in going into politics, what would you say to them? Would you tell them to consider it?
Look, I'd encourage anyone, and we need to see, I suppose, people in elective office, you know, reflecting society as it is now, and women account for more than half of the population, but not more than half of the political leaders in our society. But honestly, as someone who went into electoral politics as a young woman, I wouldn't recommend it to anyone.
Yeah.
And I'm conscious and mindful of the fact that John Francis Flynn, who's a very good friend of mine, has said on public record that he thinks he was too young when he went into politics. And I see the difference now. My sister, who's younger than me, Deirdre, is an elected councillor now, and she's absolutely loving the role. She's doing a fantastic job. But her children are much older than what mine were throughout my period in elective office, and from her children's point of view, it was much healthier for them to have their mother enter politics at that time. So I don't think it is to do with the gender either. I'm conscious that John Francis found that he assumed a position of real responsibility at a young age. And as someone who was such an advocate for a youth voice in politics, I probably sound like a hypocrite now, rather. But looking back now, was I too young? Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, 100%. Because what we were talking about earlier really impacted and affected me.
Yeah.
And I didn't have the wisdom then that I maybe have now, where I wouldn't have prioritized my work as an elected representative above everything else.
Yeah.
I think at this age, I would have been able to find a healthier work-life balance so that it wouldn't have impacted on my family to the extent that it did, and it wouldn't have started to manifest itself in physical symptoms like it did with my health towards the end.
Yeah, and like you said, when you were so young, just taking you back to that time when you were reading all those articles, you know, that were coming out that we spoke about a while ago, like, it wasn't just you it was affecting. It must have been hard for your family as well.
Yeah, like there was one article, I'll never forget it, and I'm sorry now I've forgotten the name of the journalist, I should remember it. It was disgusting. They basically wrote an article, what would you expect from a person whose mother obviously never taught her right from wrong? I mean, they were having a pop at my mother in her parenting. I have a younger brother who did what younger teenagers did, and he experimented and he found himself with a public order conviction for possession for a small quantity for his own personal use.
Yeah.
And that was spread across every newspaper, and he's visually impaired and he wears sunglasses that depending on the glare can be dark or can be light, and they got the worst possible picture of him that made him look like, you know, a gangster from, you know, a mafia group, and it was plastered in the front page of every newspaper. So my family, who were private citizens, almost had their lives scrutinized as well, and it was considered fair game for public critique, which wasn't fair in them because the choices that I and my father and subsequently my sister have made to go into elected office. Obviously, if you put yourself out there in front of the electorate, you know this is one of the risks, but your family shouldn't have to be, which is why years ago, I'll never forget, we did an interview here in Radio Kerry, Terry O'Brien and I, and we have children the same age, and we had this discussion that it'll come to a point when they get to an age where we'll have to make that decision, do we want them to be fair game by our continuing to stay involved? Because there's been a lot of people in public office whose children have been the targets of the media as well, and in my view wrongly. They have a right to privacy. We are the ones that took the decision to go before the public and put our lives out there for everyone to see. It shouldn't have fallen back on people's back children.
Onto their family and children, like you said. Was there other kind of female politicians getting, I suppose, the same kind of treatment by the public?
Look, there was an opinion letter written into one of the papers at the time, and fair play to her, and I will always be grateful to her. The woman wrote in around that whole controversy, and basically the lines she finished on when she was talking about the National Women's Council and all these other so-called, you know, feminist and women's rights organizations, she said, "What is it? We're behind you, sister. But if we don't like your politics, we'll throw you to the wolves." And I do think it was, you know, kind of like the perfect storm of, you know, that I was young and I was female, but I also was on the wrong side of what was considered politically acceptable as well. Yeah. So I became a double target. I'm not personalising this about me. There are other people who experienced the same. And I mentioned Mary Lou earlier. I think an awful lot of the public commentary about her, even when she took maternity leave, how that was used against her when she was an MEP, and that is how they managed to get her to lose her seat. There was this whole campaign ran that, you know, she does care less about the job, she's not over there for key and important votes. The woman had given birth to Garrod and she was on maternity leave, and it was used as a stick to beat her with. But thankfully in 2024 that wouldn't be allowed to happen, and rightfully, when Minister McEntee took maternity leave as a government minister, the first time ever in the history of the state, nobody criticised her for it, and that shows progress.
With government now and Sinn Féin and everything that's going on, what do you make of politics in general these days?
Not very much. And I suppose it's easy to be a hurler on the ditch. But that's part of the reason why I left as well. Because the writing was on the wall. Sinn Féin was going one particular way in terms of there was more and more electoral support coming, but there was going to be a cost to that as well. And for me, that cost would have been too high. And there are others who have stayed on course, and they would argue saying, you know, the only way to affect change is if you get into power. Whereas I would look at it, you know, if you compromise yourself so much in order to get into power, how do you achieve the change that it is that you got involved in for the first place, in the first place? So there's that. But, you know, the whole system is not one that's going to be easy to change anyway, irrespective of who goes in to government. Senior civil servants, in my personal view, yield most of the power. And I have every confidence in a handful who I think will be in ministerial office if or when Sinn Féin get into government to challenge that, and not so much confidence in others. But that's true of every political party. So I have a rather jaundiced view of the political system, having been a part of it for so long. And that's not, you know, targeted at any individual political party. It's the system overall.
But knowing, you'd have more of an insight in that you know, to look back on. Yeah. Would you be interested in looking, like, these days, there's obviously progress and everything. With even, like, my friends, I have a good few friends that had dyslexia in school. Mm-hmm. There's a lot more research and kind of resources coming in. Would you be still kind of interested in that, seeing what 100%. Progress and research is being made?
Yeah, that's why I'm an active member of our trade union. I, you know, going right back to the days when, you know, I was a member of the junior ANC, Nelson Mandela's words had a huge impact on me, and especially what he said about education being the greatest weapon that you can use to effect change and to challenge all that is wrong. So I see reform in education as being the key driver of the kind of change we need to see in this country. That's why I have stayed in the FET sector, because I think it is the one arm of the education system that can really, really challenge the inequality that's perpetuated by the Leaving Cert. The tertiary degrees that were announced last year and coming on board, I'm a huge proponent of those, and I am desperate to see them rolled out in a really efficient, effective way that can really transform the access to, you know, the more elite courses that tend to be only accessed by those who come from a particular background. So, yeah, so I see definitely a role for myself in there in trying to affect the kind of change that I try to contribute to in politics. And this is just another way in which I'm hoping to contribute.
And like you said, there's so many different things going on in the world at the moment. We see Gaza, obviously, is a massive talking point there, the whole thing that in Ukraine. And do you think that we, I was going to ask you, do you think that we treat new residents coming to Ireland well enough at the moment?
Look, I can only speak from my own personal perspective, definitely my colleagues and I do. We have embraced technology to ensure that there isn't any impediment to the education of those who come in and English isn't their first language. I personally would use a lot of the translation tools that are there. So I throw on a headset, I go into PowerPoint, and as I'm delivering my classes, it's being subtitled on the board behind me for them. Every single resource that I and my colleagues use is compatible with most of the tools that make learning more accessible. So they're the kind of things that we do. We're mindful of cultural differences. We're mindful of the need to be respectful of different political opinions in the classroom. I think we are doing our best, but as a society, maybe we could be doing a bit more.
Better, yeah. And like you said, you can only speak from your own personal stance, and like that goes for everyone. Before we finish up, I just want to talk about your PhD that you done. Do you want to talk a little bit about that? What did it involve? And do you want to, just for the listeners, explain what exactly you've done?
Yeah, so if you had told me when I finished my undergrad, Ian, that I would go on and do a master's and then do a PhD on top of that, I would have said, you're nuts.
Because
I was allergic to studying anymore at that stage. But what it was a friend of mine from my undergrad years. We met in our history lectures and we joined a society together in UL and we became friends. And he moved up through the ranks of the sociology department in UL and he was always encouraging me, come back. You need to do a research PhD. You know, you've so many areas you're interested in. You need to tease that out somewhere. So what happened was I was coming down from a meeting up the country with my father one day and we stopped at Midway in Portlaoise. And not to bore you with too much detail, but basically his subconscious reaction to somebody in that big eating hall just triggered a curiosity in me. And he got up and we left and he got into the car. He was about to tell me what happened when this knock came to the window and this guy was there and the two of them were talking and I was watching, you know, the tension between the two of them. And I think kind of a couple of minutes into it, my father realized who he was and he relaxed a little bit, but not completely.
Yeah.
So as we left, he explained to me that he saw this guy watching us in there and instinctively his subconscious reaction was one of tension and stress and fear. And he didn't know what this guy was looking at him for or why, and we left to see would he follow, and he did, and it was only midway through the conversation he realised he was a former prison officer from his time in prison.
Go away.
So it fascinated me. Number one, his, you know, subconscious response, and then number two, that former prison officer's need to come up and talk to him.
Talk to him, yeah.
And neither one of them mentioned Portlaoise prison, which was really unusual. So Martin, or Dr. Martin Power, he's now Associate Professor Martin Power from the University of Limerick, he convinced me, because we were having a chat about this, and I was like saying, Martin, this is really interesting, you should explore this. He said, no, you need to explore it. So that's how I went back and did my PhD, and I wanted to look at the relationship between the prison officers and the IRA and prisoners, because it was unique in the Irish prison system. Unfortunately, the Irish Prison Service wasn't too receptive to working with me on it, and I couldn't recruit that many prison officers, but I had gathered so much at that stage from the prisoners that my supervisors were telling me anyway, no, you need to just focus on the prisoners, because you've too much data there to now add in another cohort. So that's what I did, and I just looked at the repression of those prisoners and also their resistance in Portlaoise, how and why it happened, and what was the outcome. And that became Prisoner Yet Warden, Portlaoise Prison, 1975 to 1985.
And like you said, if you'd asked you to do a master's and now a PhD, you'd have said not a hope.
Not a hope. I was allergic, yeah.
And like that's the whole thing again, before we finish up, the see it to be it. Like, you went on and done a master's, and just because you had the dyslexia doesn't mean that it held you back. Do you know, for people listening that may have it as well, it just goes to show nothing can hold you back if you, I suppose, put your mind to it and you went on and done.
And if you have the right supports around you.
That's very important, isn't it?
Yeah, I had Professor Owen Devereux and Professor Martin Power, and if anyone out there is ever thinking of doing, you know, a research PhD or any kind of a PhD in sociology, they're the two to go to. Dream team of supervisors. I couldn't have, with all the challenges that I had, completed it without having those two as my supervisors. They were exceptional.
Very good. Thanks so much for coming in today, Noan. I really appreciate your time. I know you're very busy, so I appreciate you coming in, and thanks a million for popping in.
Thanks very much for having me in.
Now, unfortunately, that's all we have time for tonight. I hope you all enjoyed the show, and I appreciate you tuning in as always. I hope you're all having a great week so far. Stay tuned in here to Radio Kerry, because Brian Priestley is up next with That's Jazz. I'll be back at the same time next Wednesday night from 8 to 9 p.m. Until then, stay safe and mind yourself.
See it to be it on Radio Kerry with Ian O'Connell. You're listening to Stand Out with Ian O'Connell, Wednesday evenings from 8 p.m. here on Radio Kerry.